Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. The usual two guests today, first eminently is Christos Sims, who looks at the long history of American educational reform through the case study of a Manhattan middle school. And at the bottom of the hour, Christian Parenti examines the threat presented by climate change to coastal cities, where most of the world's economic and cultural activity happens. First, school reform. As we'll hear from Christos Sims, there's a long tradition in the U.S. going back to the 19th century of looking to the schools to solve our social problems, that somehow, if we got education right, everything else in society would fall into place. The latest iteration of this hardy perennial, which is getting kind of old by now, is that tech will save us, though from what I hear, some Silicon Valley execs like to send their kids to Waldorf schools where computers are forbidden. Sims spent several years studying a new public middle school in Manhattan, one that was showered with elite foundation cash from birth. Its pedagogical philosophy is a curious one. The curriculum is organized on the model of video games. Students study ancient Greece by pretending they're spies in the Peloponnesian War, or make up a game to save an imaginary town from environmental disaster. Some of this sounds like the classic project-based approach of progressive education, but with a high-tech overlay. Turns out, though, that convention quickly reasserts itself, contrary to the wishes of its founders. Christos Sims, an assistant professor of communication at the University of California, San Diego, writes up the story in his new book, Disruptive Fixation, School Reform and the Pitfalls of Techno-Idealism, published by Princeton University Press. Christos Sims. There's a long tradition in American education of trying to fix the society's problems through the schools, right?
Yeah.
You can give us the brief rundown on what that's been like. How far back does it go?
Basically, it goes as far back as there has been compulsory public schooling. And some of those fixes are fairly consistent, things like trying to create equality of opportunity, being the kind of great equalizer. Others have to do with things like trying to kind of create a harmonious polity, particularly around things like immigration, so to kind of Americanize students. But basically, from the beginning, there's always been these rather large hopes of what education can do, which have always fallen short. So one of the kind of aspects of American education in particular is just perpetual cycles where people think it's in crisis and needs urgent reform.
There's a constant discourse of crisis around the schools, and you one point quote, what, three or four passages from the early 20th century to the present. And aside from, you know, changing styles of language, the concepts are virtually identical, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's always kind of slightly different conditions, of course, in which these calls for sort of urgent and disruptive reform spring forth. But yeah, the calls are actually remarkably consistent. And then also that there's a tendency, there's a historian at Stanford named Larry Cuban, who's now retired, but he found that each time there's a new kind of technology, media technology, whether it's radio or film or, you know, the personal computer, it's like, okay, now we have the means by which to finally realize these longer-standing kind of yearnings.
Yeah, Thomas Edison thought that we'd no longer have textbooks, but just
right,
motion pictures.
Exactly. The motion picture for Edison, and there's a computer scientist at MIT, Seymour Papert, that had very similar ideas with the personal computer, and that's then, of course, been kind of remade with the internet and then mobile devices.
MOOCs. You know. MOOCs will save us now, yes. Do you have to teach one of those?
No, thankfully not. No, I get to do the old-fashioned large lecture hall, though, with 400 students, so yes. Not that that's an ideal situation either.
It seems that most of these reformers, in all their evangelical zeal, don't do much reflection on how the schools are embedded in a larger society. So if they don't change the society, they can fiddle with the schools all they like, but, you know, won't they sort of default back to what they were?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the crux of the issue, is that these larger societal issues get delegated to educational institutions and reformers, and sometimes these new technology, you know, people who specialize in whatever the new technology is at the moment, so hence the Edison reference before. And they're not unique. It's not just an education issue, but once it kind of gets delegated to these experts, there's a tendency to kind of depoliticize and kind of treat it as a technical problem as opposed to something that's very much enmeshed in broader social and political issues.
But there's a paradox in that a lot of these reformers are dependent upon experienced people in the field to show them the way, right? So that is almost a way for convention to reassert itself.
Yeah, exactly. So part of it is that a lot of times the calls for, okay, let's finally fix our schools or radically transform our schools will come from people who aren't experts in, say, education reform, and maybe they're philanthropists, or right now it's a lot of people in the tech who've accumulated quite a bit of money in the tech industries and the finance industries.
In New York City, it's all these hedge fund guys.
Right. And on the West Coast, you have that too, but there's also a lot of the kind of big tech moguls who have a stake in education reform. I think Steve Jobs' widow is about to launch some big thing in the next couple of days. So.
Yeah, and then Mark Zuckerberg is going to save the Newark schools too, right? So you did a case study in this, a school in Manhattan, whose anonymity we are intent to preserve. It came with a mission organized around technology, right? What was the founding mission of this school?
Well, the founding mission of the school was that it was very much inspired by some prominent learning theorists who had seen in video games kind of an ideal model for how to organize learning. And there's something to that, in that games provide kind of a constant series of incrementally more difficult challenges that you have to work through, and they provide a kind of world into which you're doing that, and you can kind of take on the identity of a character. And by doing that, the theory is that you learn not even necessarily by purposely thinking you're learning, you're trying to play the game, but as you do that, you're learning how to do different things. So the initial inspiration was very much tied to that sort of pedagogic philosophy, which has a long tradition, not around games per se, but going back to reformers like Dewey, as we were talking about earlier, of kind of learning by doing. This is a more active and engaging way to do kind of learning, and maybe we can translate that into a way to organize the school.
Yeah, well, for younger children, there was the use of play as a model for...
Absolutely, yeah. So play is definitely was a huge part of it. But then there's a lot of other more optimistic takes on new technologies in addition to just games. So there's a lot of people in Silicon Valley and elsewhere that have seen with more recent media technologies the prospect that we don't just have to be consumers, we can also be makers and creators and innovators and so forth. And so that was also very much part of it, that, okay, now that we have these tools that let you make and remix media and so forth, that you could use those as a way to make students more engaged and active.
Yeah, a few years ago I interviewed Terry Moe, who's one of the Uber educational reformers of the present era. And to him, computers were a cheap replacement for teachers. That he hated teachers' unions. He thought that experience really didn't matter much in the field of education, even though he was at Stanford for 30 years. And that, you know, the iPad would replace the unionized teacher in his world. This is not the model that you're talking about.
No, definitely not. The education reform world is, you know, very heterogeneous and politically divided. And like any sort of professional community, there's lots of different controversies and people arguing over which approach is better. So, yeah, there have been reformers who think this, we can use the technology to make things more efficient. MOOCs is obviously tied to that. Like, we can reach with one well-produced MOOC class, thousands and thousands of students. These reformers weren't at all trying to do that, although they did run into similar challenges, which is how do you try to scale this model? They definitely weren't trying to get rid of teachers, but they imagined teachers as having more of kind of a facilitating role rather than an authoritative one.
Okay, so how is this school filled? New York City has a very active choice program. I know it firsthand. The school was created and filled using that choice system, right?
Right. So the choice reforms in New York came about in the Bloomberg era. And the idea is that, and you know this from your own experience, in elementary school you tend to go to school in your neighborhood based on where you live. But then when you get to sixth grade, or really it starts in the fall of your fifth grade year, you start touring around different middle schools in the district, and you apply to them, and then there's a matching algorithm that nobody seems to know exactly how it works, that matches prospective families to schools. So some of the older middle schools that have been established for a while have selection criteria like exam scores and things like that in their admissions processes, but newer schools in the choice system aren't allowed to do that. So they have to use a metric called informed choice, which is then, it's pretty ambiguous, and it's left up to schools to try to figure out how to implement that.
And the student body that resulted, it started with a first or the sixth grade class, and that was going to fill upwards with time.
Yeah.
But what was it like? It was a pretty mixed student body.
Yeah. So one of the things that turned out to be one of the most kind of important and interesting aspects of the school that I hadn't anticipated, and I don't think that the people who kind of designed and launched the school had anticipated as much either, is that this was very uncommonly diverse in terms of kind of social class and race for a New York City public school. A lot of the schools are much more segregated on kind of lines of racialized social class, with parents that are more privileged and working as professionals and so forth, walking towards certain neighborhoods or certain middle schools that are hard to get into. And then a lot of the other schools being predominantly lower income students of color.
And how did that work out? And did the students get along? Did they mix up, or did they break into socially predetermined cliques?
Yeah, so I spent a lot of attention. This is actually where I kind of began the project, was with an interest in student kind of cliques and peer cultures and how do students organize into different friendship groups and things like that when they go to school. And the thinking behind that is that factors that shape their lives outside of school end up playing out in different ways within the school, but not just in terms of how students respond to pedagogy and things like that, but also in terms of how do they respond to each other. And especially at middle school, there's a lot of kind of concern amongst kids of kind of where do I fit in, who do I hang out with, who do I sit with.
Yes, the hormones are beginning to flow. And
yeah, and there's just a lot of pressure to kind of have a peer group. And so at this school, at the beginning, you saw some kind of negotiating and trying to figure it out. But pretty quickly, it settled into mostly divided cliques. Now, they weren't super antagonistic with each other, and it was a small school, so they all kind of knew each other. The students would know each other. But from a student perspective, these different cliques then have different sorts of meaning, whether you're cool or not, or how you're kind of read by other kids in the school.
But that just sounds like pretty much any school.
So yeah, that happened. Exactly.
This you know, new creation really couldn't address that classic problem of early adolescence.
No, definitely not. And there's a tradition in more critical studies of these types of issues, going back to like Paul Willis's Learning to Labor, that pays a lot of attention to how kind of the cultural worlds and practices of these kind of peer cultures end up kind of mediating things like the reproduction of class relations.
Yeah, I mean, that's the embedded into the larger society issue coming.
Right. For this school, because digital media and games were so central to their initial mission, the idea was that, today's kids are embedded and immersed in technology, and ideas like the digital generation or digital natives were very much alive and well then, and as they are still today.
But that turned out not to be fully true, right?
Right. No, absolutely. But it was a popular stereotype.
Yeah, but that's interesting. The kids were not as digitally immersed as the designers of the school thought they would be.
Right, exactly. And this is actually something that I'd seen on earlier research projects that I worked on as well. Certainly, digital technology is an integral part of all these kids' lives in very different ways. But in terms of really identifying with a sort of technological identity, which sometimes, you know, we get a label of being like geeky or something like that, it was most of the students did not identify that way. And they had other concerns and interests, even though they maybe played video games and liked video games. Maybe they were really into sports or into dance or things like that.
I'm speaking with Christo Sims, author of Disruptive Fixation. So how did this, you know, this theory of the school organized on the video game model, how did that turn into pedagogical practice?
Again, the kind of theory versus how it actually played out is quite different. I think the theory is that at the beginning of each sort of trimester in your different classes, there would be the introduction of a kind of narrative, a fictional narrative that would sort of frame the curriculum for the rest of the quarter. So in one class, it could be something like the students being invited to apply to a code-breaking academy. And by doing that, they would learn about math and different kind of skills that you would also be expected to develop in more conventional schools. But in theory, the students would see themselves as kind of playing a game and working towards these challenges to progress in the game throughout the quarter. And then at the end of the trimester. So then at the end of the trimester, there would be kind of a culminating experience, a kind of week-long session where supposedly that would all come together.
And did it work?
It's a good question because it's obviously depends on how you define work. It didn't work at all, I think, in the way that it was written about and imagined and covered in the media.
And parenthetically, this school got a lot of attention when it opened, right?
Yeah, so that was another surprise to me was the school received a tremendous amount of kind of public fanfare and attention. Some of that coming from actors you'd expect, such as foundations and people who are involved in education reform. But what would surprise me is that it got a lot of attention from broader media outlets that tended to portray the school in a very promising and optimistic way, even though it had just opened.
Okay, then back to the curriculum and whether it worked or not.
Right. I found that even at the beginning of the year, it seemed that much of what was going on actually looked quite a bit just like what you'd see in a normal school. And it became much more so over time. So, for example, it was unusual at the beginning of the quarter or trimester when they'd introduced this narrative, and that felt different and unusual and unconventional. But then very quickly it would go back to regular type of schooling activities where the teacher would be giving, you know, short tasks to the students, and they'd all do the same tasks and then, you know, have the homework and the same type of thing you would more or less see at a traditional school. But wrapped in a kind of language that was unique to these kind of fictional game worlds.
Right. So they somehow tried to reconcile the theory with the actual practice, right? How'd that work out, that act of reconciliation?
Well, I think that they were just completely in tension with each other. And in certain moments, I think they were able to reconcile it, such as those periods at the end of each trimester. They'd actually kind of suspend the normal class schedule, and it really felt like regular schooling was put on pause for a moment.
But you said it made it almost felt carnivalesque too, right?
Yeah, well, I think it was carnivalesque in the sense that it was kind of these brief moments of kind of inverting the established and kind of conventional hierarchies and so forth, but then you'd go back to normal school. But those moments became very important, I argue, in terms of how the school's perceived by outsiders and insiders, and I saw them as being very important to kind of keeping the school going from a more kind of keeping in terms of that reconciliation between the ideals and the acts.
How was the school staffed? Were the teachers and administrators from conventional backgrounds, or were they somehow unconventional?
The teachers were mostly from conventional backgrounds, although some had some kind of like media arts experience and things like that. But then there was also a team of game designers and curriculum designers in the school. So the idea was that they would work with the teachers to kind of design these innovative pedagogic experiences, and the teachers would then be kind of the executors of that.
It's funny, when we were looking around for middle schools for our kid, there's one in Manhattan, which is probably one of the most progressive, ICE it's called. And, you know, the sixth graders there were reading Julius Caesar. So, you know, you think this is a very progressive school, but they're doing something very traditional. Did they do things like that at the school you studied?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's a lot of the curriculum is actually set by state standards. So they would try to introduce some material that was not something you'd find at a conventional school, particularly in this kind of media arts class they had, where in the first year it's focused on game design. But in classes that are, you know, more focused on science or English and language arts or social science, a lot of the curriculum is set by people beyond the school, and they don't have much control over that.
In New York, it's a lot of testing that has to.
Exactly, yeah. And that gets more intense the further you go along. So in high school, it gets even more kind of regimented. But, yeah, so it's not just that there's these curricular standards, but you're being assessed and held accountable by these, you know, yearly tests.
Which brings up, you know, this the nature of education reform in the U.S. over the last couple of decades has been to create centralized standards, but then decentralized means of implementing them, right?
Yeah, so that's happened at the national level, but also New York was one of the kind of pioneers in this, was on the one hand having kind of the overall agenda of our educational systems kind of being controlled increasingly in a centralized manner, but then delegating to local school officials more autonomy over how they meet those outcomes. And the idea, and this has happened in a lot of other public institutions too, is can we try to unleash local leaders to be more innovative and creative and create kind of market-like conditions where the outcomes aren't profits, but things like test scores.
Yeah.
The measurable outcomes.
Yes, measurable. These people love metrics, but you know, it seems like none of these schemes actually deliver on the metrics, but they never seem to rethink the approach.
Yeah, and I mean, the metrics issue, I'm convinced by some critical scholars who've written about, once you have the standardized metric, you're guaranteed to have winners and losers. So everything gets organized kind of like a race, you know, hence Obama's race to the top. So there isn't a question if everybody can succeed. It just is the playing field level, which it never is. So then constant efforts to try to level the playing field.
Yeah, in a society where the sorting of winners and losers has gotten significantly more brutal over the last few decades.
Absolutely.
It's odd that people think that somehow the schools can escape that.
Right. And actually, I think schools become kind of one of the main sites where that intense competition plays out. And New York is more so than most places, but I think you see this pretty pervasively, that the pressures on families and students to kind of win in that game are pretty intense because the stakes are so high on the other side.
This particular experiment, but I think this is a general principle, as you argue, that these things that begin with a sense of experimentation, of disruption, kind of end up falling back into convention. What does that say for the whole project of school reform? Can it be done, or should we just try to figure out how to make the best with what we've got?
I mean, I think there's always ways to run a school or run a classroom better or worse, but that will change quite a bit on the kind of local situation and what type of students you have and so forth. So I'm all for empowering teachers to have more autonomy and trying to reprofessionalize the profession. But I think as long as these sort of broader social issues are delegated to schools and we expect them to fix those, then failure is going to be almost inevitable. So from my perspective, I think it would be, at least at the political level, much more effective to try to look at those broader structures and look at things like inequity of distribution and not just think that we can turn this into an educational problem.
Yeah, it's funny. People hold up Finland as a model very frequently. Finland is a Nordic social democracy, relatively egalitarian distribution of income, an incarceration rate a tenth of ours, and it doesn't seem like you can just pick up models out of the Finnish educational system and think you can import them here without like the rest of the model coming along.
No, exactly. And I do think that you could see something like that exist here if we did have a very different political economy.
But this hope of some magic bullet that will fix the schools persists.
Oh, yeah. It persists and keeps getting regenerated. And part of that is that, at least with people who kind of lead with technology and their reform efforts, there's always a new, hot, and often overly hyped media technology. Right now it might be virtual reality. And, you know, all this talk about it's completely unprecedented, and now we can finally do things we could never do before. And I think that helps allow the sort of regeneration of the cycle of optimism that now we can finally fix these problems.
The more things change.
Exactly.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I was Christo Sims, Assistant Professor of Communication at the University of California, San Diego, and author of Disruptive Fixation from Princeton University Press. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwin, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break.
Go back. You can never go back.
was some of Watch Your Back by the Coat Hangers, today's musical theme, Feminist Punk Rockers. Next, climate change and urban civilization. Over the last decade, we've seen Katrina wreck a bunch of New Orleans, Sandy play havoc with New York City and environs, and most recently, Harvey inundate Houston. As I record this, Irma is bearing down on Miami, having slapped around several islands in the Caribbean as a warm-up. With climate change seriously underway, these sorts of storms will become more frequent and more intense. What will that mean for our coastal cities as the oceans rise? Are they doomed? If so, what will that mean to a civilization that's heavily based in urban centers on the water? And is there anything we can do about it, or must we resign ourselves to doom? Christian Parenti, who teaches at John Jay College at the City University of New York, has a piece in the current issue of Jacobin Magazine, which is also on its website at jacobinmag.com, on precisely these topics. He took on the threat to the poor regions of the planet posed by climate change in his most recent book, Tropic of Chaos, from Nation Books. Christian Parenti. We've just been through Harvey, well, mostly through Harvey, and Irma's on the way. But the Harvey disaster pointed to risks to coastal cities, and most of our industrial civilization is coastal. So what's the scope of the problem here?
Well, the scope of the problem depends really on, you know, how much planning there is. But the science is very clear. There are 14 major computer models that have been running for at least 30 years. And, you know, we now have 30 years of observations to compare to their projections. And it turns out their projections have been more correct than wrong. And we're in for rising sea levels and more frequent and intense storms. And interestingly, we actually have, you know, while there are more intense and actually more frequent hurricanes already occurring, they are a higher percentage of hurricanes over the last 10 years have been turning away from the Atlantic coast. And scientists think this has to do with rising temperatures on land.
I saw a right-wing Yahoo the other day who said, it's the Washington Times, I believe. We don't have to worry about climate change because no major hurricanes have hit the U.S. in the last 10 or 12 years. So, therefore,
that was before Harvey.
No, it's after Harvey. Really well. This was the first in 10 or 12 years to make landfall.
Yeah. So, well, I mean, you know, so there's that. We've been living under that weird anomaly. But, yeah, so the science is very clear. We can expect more of this. And sea levels are rising. They rise unevenly. The seas are actually uneven. And the North Atlantic is rising faster than the average, and the best science compiled by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change projects minimum of like 3 feet sea level rise, probably more like over 6 feet by the end of the century. But the main problem is the storm surges, and so that's what we're looking for. And
now, just to make the point clear, it's no longer correct to speak of the climate crisis in the future tense.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah, we're in it. And so what my article was about was, you know, looking at the question of urban infrastructure. What happens when there's frequent inundations and all of these municipalities are dependent on the property values to raise money to build defenses? And so there's this, everyone is hostage to property values. Landlords and homeowners don't want to say, I'm selling because I'm afraid of sea level rises. Governments that recognize this can't actually plan publicly about it that easily without potentially inviting a collapse in property values, and they need that for their tax base to build the defenses, to be those seawalls or, you know, buying out coastal homes to sort of rewild and build, you know, new wetlands and you know, bio-shields, as they're sometimes called, to break storm surges. So we're in for more of this. What the time frame is, who knows? But you can imagine that eventually with more and more inundations of urban infrastructure, the process of rebuilding is going to be too expensive, and a kind of rot will set in, and there will eventually be a kind of panic, a real estate panic around coastal infrastructure, and there'll be a shift inward by capital and the population. And you can imagine a new urban kind of coastal ghetto, a climate created sort of sacrifice zone, similar to the Rust Belt. You know, I mean, the Rust Belt was, when it first emerged, was really sort of mind blowing that these developed and prosperous cities like Detroit and St. Louis could fall into dilapidation. And it's still really arresting when you go to these places and you see these beautiful houses that were once, you know, incredibly expensive and have all of this valuable labor and materials in them, and yet the cities are vacant and dead, et cetera. So, I mean, what I was proposing is I think that's probably going to be one of the first ways that climate change really manifests. Because sometimes we think of, like, climate change as just all these bad things happening all at once, everything is just sudden apocalypse, but it's probably not going to go like that. And, you know, agriculture probably will adapt much more easily than major coastal cities that haven't built any kind of defenses.
I can't remember the exact number, but it's something in the order of 4 or 5 metropolitan areas in the U.S. are now responsible for something like half of GDP. And I think that's probably true around the world. The coastal cities are, as income and wealth have gotten more unequally distributed, so they've also gotten more unequally distributed geographically.
Mm-hmm.
So we've seen this rising importance of coastal metropolises over the last 20, 30. So we're talking about a pervasive crisis for the entire system.
Yeah. Yeah.
And these people who talk like, oh, we can't afford to address the climate crisis, are seem to be missing the fact that if we don't, there ain't going to be any money.
Yeah. It would be interesting for economists to try and calculate what the disappearance of Manhattan real estate overnight would do. It wouldn't happen like that, but like I think we have like $1 trillion worth of property in New York City.
What about the fourth largest metro area in the U.S. now, Houston?
Yeah.
Is a mess. We have no idea what's going to happen to it, what the long-term consequences are. They will be severe. And now if Irma hits Miami, you know, that's another major metropolitan area within the space of weeks. So, you know, we have this real-world experiment going on.
Yeah, we do. And there, I mean, coastal cities are important because of their value, and that can have reverberations into financial markets, and also their choke points for international trade. Chatham House did a study, and they found that like 55% of world grain goes through 14 key choke points, many of which are ports. So there's that aspect of it. You know, what happens to a globalized economy when crucial connective nodes fall into disrepair and crisis? And we don't know. That's the thing. We don't know. And we're not planning about it, and we're not talking about it.
Let's talk a bit about New York City. Your piece does some of that. We had Sandy, 4 or 5 years ago, and you walk around the city, you don't really see lingering effects of it, but they're there, right?
Yeah, there's the main one is that, you know, the L line is going to be shut down. That we're going to feel. The tunnel inundated and the salt water got into crevices and it's going to require a complete rehab. But yeah, and there's a lot of money thrown at Sandy. And so in a way, you know, we don't see it because there was sufficient investment. I forget what the number, but there's like several $1 billion has been invested in response to building artificial reefs. There's, you know, so there's a lot of money was actually.
Now they're building a U around Lower Manhattan?
Yes, they're building a U, and that may or may not be sufficient. But we don't see the effects of Sandy in part because there was significant amounts of investment that went into the recovery and the rebuilding. But if that, you know, if it had been much worse, if there are 3 or 4 of those, that's going to become much less likely.
Bloomberg was obsessed with preparations, rather grandiose ones. He wanted to like build a, like this giant sea arm out in, you know, across between Staten Island and New Jersey to prevent surges and such. Is his successor thinking about these things at all?
Bill de Blasio?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean, Bill de Blasio is, you know, he's building the U, but he's also building a tram at the, I think, the expense of like $1.5 billion along the Brooklyn waterfront. He's not acknowledging the real scope of the problem because he doesn't want to scare all of the parties who are hostage to real estate values. I mean, one can only imagine what it would be like to have to go into a room of like major real estate moguls after having given some major speech about climate change. You know, if you're the mayor and like the kind of hostility they would give you. So he wants to get reelected. So, yeah, he's doing the minimum. And most cities are, you know, doing merely the minimum. And further south, it's even worse. But it's beginning to seep in, no pun intended. Like in Miami, the flooding is becoming so routine that the denial is kind of giving way. It's clear that a lot of neighborhoods are already suffering from just routine, not storm surges, routine sunshine flooding. And there have been academic studies that suggest that gentrification in Miami is now responding, that higher points of elevation are receiving more investment, that patterns have shifted. And it seems to be because of this, you know, kind of organic word of mouth acknowledgement that there's constant flooding down on the coast. So, yeah, but by and large, nothing is being done. Everyone is hostage to property values. And it seems very unlikely that that will change unless there's a series of, Joe Rahm, who writes a climate journalist, has talked about a climate Pearl Harbor. I mean, that may or may not work, but maybe if there are a series of floods that devastate major cities in a period of 1 or 2 years, the problem becomes undeniable and there's a complete rethink around all this. And that could happen. And one thing,
Harvey is a good candidate for something like that.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that...
But then you have people like Ann Coulter who said that Houston having a lesbian mayor is a better explanation for Harvey destroying Houston than climate change.
But I think that in terms of these storms, you know, there's an opening for the left as well, which is that in the moment of crisis response, we see the mainstream story about the market handling all problems, being omniscient, omnipotent. We see that evaporate. And instead, what we see is human solidarity in action and also being celebrated by the mainstream. And there's also a legitimation of redistribution that's pretty interesting. All of these people who are going to the convention centers and the churches in Houston and are getting, quote-unquote, free stuff, right, that the right is constantly condemning. It's like, for a moment at least, that's totally legitimate. Beyond legitimate, it's noble to help out those in need. That opens the door to a larger conversation, which is like, really? So maybe it's okay to redistribute to who, for how long, why? Let's extend this conversation. But we don't really have movements that do that, nor even really a kind of discourse around this. Mostly what the left does, which is completely reasonable, is to focus on how the neoliberal forces use these moments of crisis to try and privatize infrastructure, most famously schools in New Orleans after Katrina. But you know, with enough organization and analysis, I think these storms could actually lead to a type of storm socialism if we had the power, if we had the movements, where we'd say, look, how is it that on a sunny day when everything is fine, you know, this society condemns altruism, but when push comes to shove, redistribution, solidarity, altruism, suspending the tyranny of prices, you know, that's okay. Maybe, in fact, our society needs to be structured along the lines of those moments of emergency response when people come together and share.
Tyler Cowen, though, says that price gouging in a disaster is economically rational because it draws capital into the disaster region. So we still have your ideologues of capital coming in. But the fact is that capitalism is very bad at dealing with long-term things like this. Like, it's impossible if you have some sort of standard financial valuation model, something that may happen 10, 20 years out just doesn't figure at all. As Keynes said, the average man discounts the future at a very high rate. We want everything now, and we don't want to think about the consequences. It's an economic system, but also the psychology that it creates makes it very, very difficult to not even adapt, but even conceive of the problem in its proper dimensions.
Mm-hmm. This is true, yeah. Yeah, and I mean, the ideological war rages, you know, in terms of what I was just saying, like these possible openings, that you had these moments of solidarity during the crisis. But of course, those moments of solidarity are latched onto by right-wing ideologues and used to justify a libertarian future. Why do you need civil defense? Why do you need the state when you have the Cajun Navy, a bunch of volunteers in their private boats coordinating?
Well, there's a left version of that, too. We've got, you know, anarchist mutual aid will step in where the state is absent. And there's just no substitute for an effective state.
This is true. This is true, yeah. Anarcho-liberalism enables that kind of libertarian nonsense.
Yeah, it was a brilliant coinage by Bhaskar Sankara, anarcho-liberalism.
I'm speaking with Christian Parenti, author of Tropic of Chaos and If We Fail, in the current issue of Jacobin magazine.
And we've been talking about the U.S. And a couple of coastal cities, but this is a worldwide problem. And in poor countries where there are also coastal cities at risk, what's it going to look like there?
Who knows? But from my travels in such places and my reading, I think there is like almost no planning done in places like Lagos, Nigeria, and Rio. And it's going to look like a more extreme version of what's already going on in the megacities of the global south. Inequality, intense violence, suffering, disease. In terms of the question, what's the future going to look like on an unequal planet? And my answer is usually like it's going to look like a more extreme version of the present. I mean, we're in the climate crisis, as you said. I mean, we're also in the sort of authoritarian, dystopian, distracted, hyper-violent future that we all imagined. Maybe not its worst version, but I mean, it's all around us. The levels of millenarian madness, violence, desperation, spreading disease. That was my last book was all about that. But so that's what it looked like. It looked like waves of people moving inland, the shifts in population leading to religious and ethnic conflicts. It's a nightmare. You know, it could be dealt with planning, and there is the technology and there is the money and there is the expertise to do this if we had the political power to force the conversation in a different direction.
I want to get to that what is to be done point in a moment, but just to underscore the inadequacy of planning in reaction to the present, Trump's EPA is a frightful thing. And he may be an incompetent buffoon on many other issues, but his man at the EPA, Pruitt, has just totally transformed that organization into doing just the opposite of what it's supposed to do. So now they're completely MIA in Houston, right?
Yeah. MIA in Houston, there's 13 Superfund sites have been flooded. Yeah.
The chemical plant blew up.
Mm-hmm. There was a nuke plant that luckily has survived, but, you know, was almost inundated, a major atomic power plant. Yeah, it's pretty intense. And for sure, there's not going to be any kind of study or remediation. I'm not even sure. How would you remediate that level of, you know, distribution of dioxin and these other, like, highly carcinogenic materials throughout such a wide region? Strip the topsoil from hundreds of square miles. It doesn't make any sense. You can't do that.
No, but I did notice this pundit, Greg Valliere, who watches Washington for Wall Street, has been doing that for several decades, said in his morning write-up that maybe, you look at Houston now, maybe it's not a good idea to have a non-functioning EPA. So, you know, you're seeing perhaps a dawning of consciousness in some unexpected circles.
Yeah, and what gets us to a new administration, but that's a whole other
yes.
discussion.
But now let's talk about, you know, this sort of talk can lead one to despair, and despair can lead to resignation and inaction, because if you can't do anything, why not just have another drink,
mm-hmm.
right? But there are things that could be done.
Mm-hmm.
If we had, and we wouldn't need a revolutionary transformation either of our politics or our technology, right? This is mm-hmm. something that could more or less be done,
yeah.
right? So
yeah.
what kinds of things are you talking about?
Yeah, so this is like a point I'm constantly harping on because I feel that cynicism is one of our greatest enemies, and cynicism can seem quite rational. As I've said many times before, you know, we have the money, we have the laws even, we have Massachusetts versus EPA ended up making it necessary for the EPA to use the Clean Air Act to fine emitters, to fine carbon emitters. Industries would still be free to emit carbon, but they would have to pay massive fines. But these laws have not been promulgated. I mean, this is, you know, everything is in place to do this, but it has not been promulgated neither by the Bush administration, the Obama administration, nor the Trump administration, which won't do it. There's the technology. But then there's always the issue of, like, well, there's, you know, we've crossed the tipping point. There's too much CO2 in the atmosphere. And that is a pretty overwhelming fact. But there's actually new technology. For a long time, we've had the ability to strip CO2 out of the atmosphere at a rate 100 times faster than trees can do it, and then very easily and not too expensively turn it into a critical gas. The problem was always, well, how do you store this? And it can leak out, and CO2 gas is poisonous. In Iceland, just in the last 2 years, an experiment has been done whereby they mix, not sulfuric acid, some sort of acid, something like sulfuric acid, with water and inject CO2 into it. It's essentially like carbonated acidic water that's then pushed down into basalt rock formations. And there's no heat involved in this. It's not like there's a huge energy input. And in less than 2 years, the CO2 gas turns into limestone. It's an acceleration of a natural process called weathering. So this is called enhanced weathering. And, I mean, that is incredible news. I mean, we have the technology to strip CO2 out of the atmosphere in huge amounts and to store it safely.
That's very expensive, though.
Yeah, presumably, but not as expensive as the loss of society. But, you know, right now, the main discourse around this is it just assumes that the private sector would somehow bring this to scale, which is ridiculous. What's the market? I mean, who are you going to sell this, like, stored CO2 underground to? So, obviously, what has to be done is states have to take this technology and fund a project of stripping CO2 out of the atmosphere and storing it like this. And so that might sound crazy, but it's like that technology exists. It's not geoengineering, polluting the atmosphere with sulfur particles to reflect sunlight, which is nuts and would be equally expensive. But these are the kinds of things that have to be thought about and demanded. And this is what states should be doing with their, you know, massive military resources. Just knowing that, I feel like, is important because it means it's not that it is going to happen, but it means that, you know, you can make a credible case based in real facts for why it's not going to all just end in anarchy and, you know, horrible disease and epidemics.
Now, to be fair, there's some climate activists on the left who don't like these kinds of mitigation schemes, right? Like carbon capture.
Yeah, well, they don't like it because it's a techno fix, that's the line. And there's an anti-technology bias. And they also don't like it because the way it's currently used is often by the fossil fuel industry to justify burning fossil fuels. So the milieu and the discourse in which these technologies are embedded are highly problematic, but that does not mean that the technologies themselves are bad. This is the classic problem that Marx talked about, right? The social relations become a fetter on the forces of production. That's exactly what we have with this kind of carbon capture and sequestration. Obviously, yes, the mainstream discourse around that stuff is ridiculous, but that technology is not. It's actually very important.
What do you think about things like a carbon tax?
I think a carbon tax would be very important, and we just, politically, it would be impossible in this country, but that's why Massachusetts versus EPA is so important, because that's a de facto carbon tax. The fact that the EPA is required to tax polluters, but it isn't, I mean, that's the same as a carbon tax. It means, you know, if you're going to burn coal, you're going to pay a large sum of money to the government, and it's going to make burning coal not economically feasible. So we have the law to implement immediately a de facto carbon tax, and we have for about 10 years. And even the environmental movement has basically not really been talking about this that much.
Let's conclude with the political configuration here, because you have a group of people, relatively small but very rich, like the Kochs are the exemplars of it. But these are people, mostly private firms, private equity guys, who have made a ton of money by debasing the environment and hate everything to do with the state because it threatens their fortunes. That's a lot of the people behind the Trump administration, and the Trump administration is full of folks like that. You have kind of a mainstream of big capital, you know, the core of the bourgeoisie that is kind of, you know, like softly interested in climate change, but not passionately so. Michael Bloomberg is a rarity among that crowd. And then there's not much of a popular force to get active on it. So how can we, you know, make the necessary mobilization to save ourselves?
Well, I think that I don't have an answer, but I think that these inundations are, you know, potentially going to produce their own populations. That it might, the activism around climate change might not focus on mitigation so much as adaptation. That's going to be the entry point. And when you have like 100,000 houses that are near destroyed in Houston, and 85% of them don't have flood insurance, and the federal government so far doesn't seem like it's willing to bail everyone out, you know, what kind of political movements will come out of this coastal sacrifice zone? I think that might be where there could be a mass constituency that starts really pressuring for action on this. And it will be in response to adaptation, adapting to these crises and to recovery from these crises. And then that will link into the the deeper problem of, well, how do we mitigate it? How do we get off fossil fuels?
Coast dwellers of the world unite.
You have nothing but your homes to lose.
Or to gain.
That's right. Yeah.
Host Christian Parenti, author of If We Fail on the Current Issue of Jacobin. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. I've reached the age where I look to the New York Times for musical tips. Embarrassing, I know. Here's a band I learned about in a piece they ran on September 1st, Rock's Not Dead, It's Ruled by Women. This is a bit of Diana La Cazzadora from War on Women. Till next week, bye.